reallocate. That's what I say, to reallocate.
Today is Monday, February 27th. A quorum being present, the Committee on Local Government and Elections will come to order. The first bill on the agenda is Senate File 1737. Senator Lilly, welcome to the committee. I understand you have an amendment to the bill.
Yes, we do. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe it's the A1 amendment.
Let's put the bill in the shape you'd like it in for presentation.
Yes.
Chair will move the A1 amendment. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Amendment's adopted. Senator Lilly, two-year bill.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you very much for allowing us to come in today. What we have is we have a bill that allows that creates a banking tool that allows local government dollars to be kept and reinvested in the communities where those government entities reside. Currently, banks must provide about 110% collateral for all public funds in excess of the FDIC limits. Senate File 1737 gives banks and local governments another option when depositing these types of funds. Banks would not be limited in the amount of deposits they can accept by their ability to provide 110% collateral, so more banks could bid on public funds. And I have Steve Davis with me today, and he would explain the legislation in more detail.
Mr. Davis, welcome to the committee. Can you state your name for the tape, please?
Certainly. Mr. Chairman, I'm Steve Davis. I'm from Des Moines. I work for Promontory Interfinancial Network. Thank you very much for inviting me. This is a technical adjustment to a program that's been available to Minnesota banks for 8 years, where they could use CDs to extend the FDIC coverage for public funds. Currently, about $1.7 billion have stayed in Minnesota protected by FDIC insurance. So in essence, this allows the banks to keep the money locally where the funds are raised and put them out for loans and economic development. The technical change is there is now a money market available to do exactly the same thing. Many of the public entities have asked for a liquid fund to go with the CD fund, and this is the addition of the money market to the current CDER CD program.
Thank you. Any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sieben.
Senator Lilly, are credit unions, have the credit unions been in touch with you, or does this not apply to those types of institutions? Or
Senator Lilly.
If they're opposing or supporting it?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sieben, actually we have been in conversation with credit unions, and there are representatives here from the credit union industry. Our discussions were that we would perhaps offer amendments that would create the same thing for credit unions, the same opportunity for credit unions, in the Commerce Committee, where they evaluate these products a little differently than we do here in local government. But if those folks would like to comment, I'd be happy to hear.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Mara Humphrey with the Minnesota Credit Union Network. Yes, we've been in discussions with the senator about including credit unions in this bill as well.
Okay.
Any further discussion? Would anyone else like to speak for or against Senate File 1737? Seeing none, the chair moves that Senate File 1737 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Consumer Protection. All those
Mr.
in
chair,
favor say
Mr.
aye.
Chair.
Senator Limmer.
There's a number of amendments in the packet. Did you act on those?
Senator Limmer, we adopted one amendment, the A3, was it? A1.
All right.
The others are going to discuss in the Commerce Committee, it sounds like.
All right.
Anyone else? Okay. Move that Senate File 1737 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Consumer Protection. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? No. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Lilly.
Members.
Next bill on the agenda is Senate File 1761. Senator Lowry.
Excellent.
Other folks want to say anything in there?
See anybody?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is Senate File 1761. This is a request that came to me from the City of Sandstone and the Economic Development Authority in Sandstone as well. And it's regarding a city-owned apartment complex in the City of Sandstone that is about 17, 18 years old now, starting to show some signs of age. The city has struggled with the management of it over the years, and there seems to be the agreement, at least within the city council and with the EDA, that probably the best course of action would be to sell this apartment complex to private developers that could put in the renovations needed and bring it up to specs and run it better. But there is a there's outstanding bonds, GO bonds, and there's a state law that requires that the EDA maintain ownership because of these bonds. And so, to my mind, it's really a local issue as to whether they want to own the apartment or sell it to the developer. With this state statute in the way, that precludes the sale. And so I said I'd entertain coming down here and having a discussion with the committee and with the legislature about whether we should waive that statutory provision to allow for the sale for the City of Sandstone. Here with me today is the city administrator, Sam Griffith, to kind of present the bill. And I don't see anybody else here from Sandstone, but in all fairness, it is not absolutely uniformly agreed to throughout the community, and so I need to at least say that. But there has been a strong vote of the city council, and they do have the backing of the Economic Development Authority. And with that, I will leave it to Sam Griffith to further describe exactly the history and why we're making this ask today.
Mr. Griffith, welcome to the committee. Could you state your name for the tape, please?
My name is Sam Griffith. I am the city administrator for the City of Sandstone, as well as the executive director of the Sandstone EDA, among other things, yes. Thank you for this opportunity. Back in 1994, the EDA issued three tax-exempt bonds for a little over $5.1 million for the purposes of developing some rental housing within the city. We built 36 townhome units for families and 36 senior units in a three-story building downtown. The general obligation of the city was pledged as additional security on these bonds. Please understand that there was no other subsidy, federal or state, involved with this. There was no Farmers Home money, no Section 8 money, no USDA money, no Minnesota Housing Finance Agency money. We just went out and built it. We did refund the bonds in 2004. But basically, since the beginning, we have been having some issues with occupancy. In the just-finished year 2011, we actually made an overall occupancy of 91%, which is the highest total occupancy level that we've had in the building since day one. We've actually been in the low 80s as an average. What that means for the city is, because of the general obligation pledge, we've had to levy every year to make up the difference in the debt service. And for about the last 4 years, we've been levying $150,000. That might not sound like much, but our levy in 2011 was $447,000, so one-third of the city's levy is going to make up this debt service. In fact, under the current financing, even if we were 100% occupied, we still wouldn't break even. So basically what we have is we have an underwater mortgage. We owe roughly $4.2 million. The county assessor says, well, you know, if we look at the income level, it's probably worth 2.6, 2.7. And so, you know, we have that issue. The other thing is the building is entering its 18th year of service. It is showing its age. There are some deferred improvements, and there's some additional maintenance that needs to be done. And about a year ago, in conjunction with our management company, we went out and took a look and said, look, what's everything that's going to need to be done over the next 10 years? And we came up in today's dollars, figuring it costs us about 1.2 to completely bring it up to current codes and things. We did have a private developer come in who would do a tax credit deal. He came in and looked at it. He figures it would take about $1.1 million to do this. Now, to put this into perspective, annually we put $14,400 a year into our repair and replacement reserve, and at the end of 2011, we had about $95,000. So here's the issue. The way the bonds are currently set up, we're paying on the revenue bonds, paying interest only on the general obligation bonds. The revenue bonds will be paid off in 2018. We will start paying on the general obligation bonds in 2019. Now, because we issued $3 million in general obligation, that's the maximum that we can levy, or that's the maximum that we can obligate because of the size of the city. So it's not until 2023 that we would have the ability to refund, to generate extra money to actually do the improvements. Currently, the buildings will be paid off in 2029. We'll have a 35-year-old building. And obviously, in order to keep the building so that it's rentable, we need to do this. Plus, you know, the part of this is, you know, the other part of this is that because were no subsidies or anything like this with this, we're at the top of the market as far as rents are concerned. And so, well, could we raise more money for our repair and replacement reserve? Sure, but once again, then that would put us even higher as far as where the market is. One of the options, and please understand, I want to be very clear, the city and the EDA have not decided whether or not they're going to sell the property. What we're asking for here is to make sure that that's an option that we can put on the table. But one of the ways that we could preserve the asset is we have talked to a developer who has experience in doing this, and basically what we'd be looking at is a tax credit deal, where he would use private financing, sell the tax credits, use the tax credits for the purposes of doing the improvements, basically obligate the building for 30 years to stay available to low and moderate income. And what would actually happen is the rents would actually go down. In fact, the rents would go down about $100 per unit per month. For example, right now, the one-bedroom units we're renting for anywhere from $660 to $775, and that does include utilities. But under the tax credits, those would rent for about $550 to $560. So basically what we're – and just one other kind of thing, when you're talking about this, to this point in time, the city has levied $1.3 million for purposes of paying debt service shortfall on this particular building. And if you look at where that $150,000 goes, basically those are 72 units. So that means basically we're paying with that $150,000, that's $173 per month per unit in subsidy. That's if it's 100% full. If we're at 80% where we were for about for a number of years, that's over $215 per month per unit. So what we're asking for is, as part of our discussions, as we try and figure out what we're going to do with our project, we would like to have the opportunity to have the ability to at least consider the sale. And I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Griffith, one question. What made you decide to get into this business? Was it through an HRA or anything, or just through the city?
In 1994, the city did have an HRA, which converted to an EDA. We were like a lot of other small rural communities. How do you bring new people into town? Even if your job base is growing, if there are no housing available for them to live in or to rent, you can't bring people into town. And so the determination at that time by the EDA was to build rental housing. We had some other housing, but it was all low-income housing. And this was an attempt to create some moderate-income rental housing to provide another to provide additional housing opportunities.
Mr. Griffith, were there no builders or anyone else developing property up there at the time? Or?
At that time, no.
Would you suggest that we get more into the business here in the metro?
I think that's beyond, there's no safe answer to that one.
Any other questions for Mr. Griffith? Senator Lemmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Griffith, if we gave you the opportunity or the option to sell, what happens to the existing bond balance? In your testimony, you said that there's a $4.2 million owed
correct
balance, and the property is worth $2.6 million now. So what happens with the security for the bond investors? How do they get paid if
Mr.
you can't
Griffith
sell the property for $2 million more than what it's worth?
Mr. Chair, members of the Senator, here's if we were to do there's two possible options. Obviously, we could try and sell it, you know, to someone who would pay, you know, if how do I answer this? Let's go back to your specific question. Excuse me. Basically, if we do the tax credit deal, we would get approximately $3 million. Okay, of that $3 million. And you know, keep your pencils handy here, we would take back a $300,000 note. So if we sell for $3 million, that would leave us $1.2 million. We take back the three, that puts us to $1.5 million. There's about $100,000 in closing costs, those kind of things. Those are $1.6 million, okay? Still, in a case like this, according to our bond counsel, we could refinance that, if that's the proper term, and I'm sure bond counsel are cringing, that 1.6 and continue to pay that as a general obligation debt. There would just be no asset against which it would be.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Senator Lemmer.
When we authorize a sale, I know in this committee, we get into the idea of how do we find a buyer? Is it just a simple sale where we find someone in the community or outside of the community that wants to make a deal with the city? Or do we put it up more for a public type sale through an auction? Maybe even a silent auction, but it's sealed bids, and that way we might get a better sale price on behalf of the taxpayers. How would this transaction be administrated if we gave you this authority?
Mr. Griffith.
Mr. Chair and Senators, to be perfectly honest, that's kind of what we're working through. Right now we do have a developer who does this type of project, does new tax credits, and in working through with our legal counsel and bond counsel, they've kind of laid it out as you know, as we've explained. Yes, we would continue on with some debt, but at least we would know what that debt would be for how long. Right now we're levying 150. Who knows if and we're at 90% occupancy. What happens if next year, God forbid, the economy improve? Every time the economy improves, vacancy rates you know, seem to dip. You know, what happens if next year we have to levy 175? Plus, there's the unanswered question of at what point in time do we do the necessary deferred improvements that need to be done. A second part to that answer is, you know, obviously we would need to make it known outside of Sandstone that the property is available, that all of the information is there in case there is a private party, whether that's local or not local, that might be interested in the property.
Mr. Griffith, I guess more directly maybe to that question is, how are you going to determine the sale price? Is that just going to be a what you're based on? According to this legislation, this says at fair market value. How do you see this actually transpiring?
How I would...
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. One of the things in the statute says that it has to be sold for fair market value, so we would have an appraisal done. So regardless of to whom we would sell the property, it would have to be at a fair market value.
Thank you. Any other? Senator Lemmer.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Mr. Griffith, you had given a scenario where the city may have to carry back some unsecured debt.
Correct.
How would that affect the bond rating? The bond was issued originally with the security of the property, and now it's being changed and altered. There's no longer a security backing the unsecured dollar amount. So is that going to affect your bond rating for your city?
Mr. Griffith.
Mr. Chair, Senator, the city doesn't have a bond rating. And the second part of that, would we pay a slightly higher interest rate? Yes.
So, Mr. Griffith, if this were to transpire, you've got $150,000 negative annually. Is that, do I understand it, currently out of there?
Would you repeat that? I didn't catch
that. $150,000 negative annually. Is that your estimate today, as of today?
Yes.
And your $4.2 million is your current debt?
Correct.
And you have about $95,000 in reserves?
Correct.
Is that correct? Okay, so if you sell this $1.2 million short, then is the... And you're short, if you sold it for $3 million and you were short the $1.2 million, is the lender going to let you do that, or isn't there a lender, isn't this related as security on the building, on the real estate?
Bond is the debt.
According to our legal counsel and our bond counsel, we could issue the continuing general obligation debt. It just would not be backed by an asset.
And currently it is backed by an asset?
Correct.
The building secures it.
So how do you unback bonds that are backed by an asset? Is there anyone in the room that... I'm just not that familiar with bonds, I guess. If that... Pardon me? Do you pay off the bonds and then re-let them out? Is that...
My understanding is that we would issue new debt, new general obligation debt, in the amount that was still owed.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Lemmer.
This is one of these situations that you learn in real estate continued education, where how do you handle a debt that is going down in value? You're losing a negative cash flow every year, and at the same time, right now you can't sell it, so you're stuck with the situation, and so there's a drain on the city for being involved in the property in the first place, and yet they're looking for an option so they can at least sell it and maybe make some forward progression. It's probably not the perfect solution. And I don't know how else they can move away from this and maybe secure their own cash flow for their city. It's kind of unusual. We haven't come up to this, but in light of real estate values and maybe the economy in rural Minnesota, it may be the only option they may have.
You could do what attorneys do when they get an interesting legal debate going in committee and go on for days.
Let's not do that. Do it as real estate agents. I'm not an attorney, Mr. Chair, so yeah. I'm incapable of going on.
No, but we're real estate agents. This is a real estate thing. We could bore everyone to tears if we want. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Is there a question for the witnesses? Or
no, I got the message, Mr. Chairman.
Any further discussion? Anyone in the audience care to testify for or against this? Seeing none. Senator Reinert, would you care to move the bill?
I would, Mr. Chair.
Senator Reinert moves that Senate File 1761, as amended, be recommended to pass and placed on general orders. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, motion prevails.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Senator Daley, is he here?
Thank you.
accusing me of being an attorney. Not that I was always a good man. He was accusing me of being an attorney. I don't know how you got it as well.
No. I'll defend you on that one. So.
Yeah, but now it just makes it worse. Now an attorney's going to defend. I'm getting a lot of it. Six to eight years.
Three kids who are in school who have lawyers. You're in a legal team, right?
Not lawyers. No. Yeah. So I'm not going to be able to. I won't be able to. I'll have the time to exercise it.
I was going to say, do you want one?
I don't think I do. Too many of them out there anyway.
Yeah, I have a bunch of friends who are cops who went back. LAA was up and got lotteries and practice.
Right.
So they all went and got it. They had their shingle and they cast the bar and then they hung it up and never wore it again. Other than that,
I did take my notes back in 1977.
I think I took it the same year, actually. So,
averaging college class, I got about 50% down. I would delete everything.
Can you send that to your committee?
This is the first time that you've been.
This one, yeah. That would be a guess, though.
Must be a really important bill. Look at all the
pieces. Have you seen the
Senator Lilly, welcome to the committee. You have Senate File 1741. You have the A6 amendment. Is that the most recent?
Yeah, exactly.
It is, Mr. Chairman, and I'm the other Ted.
Okay.
Well,
let's see, Senator.
I'll move Daly.
Cruz would like to move the A6. Oh, Senator Wolf moves the A6 amendment.
Okay.
We move to the Senate File 1741. Any discussion to that amendment? Seeing none. All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Amendment's adopted. Senator Daly, would you like to explain your bill to us?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senators. Since the bill was introduced, I've received some helpful feedback. And I appreciate your help in getting this bill into the shape and form that we want it to be so we can start this conversation. The purpose of the bill is to provide greater clarity and a straightforward view for our citizens of their local government budgeting and spending.
Typically, local government budgets are presented in terms of program areas: police, fire, public works, general procurement, other, or general government. This requires an additional view, a commonly understood view, including supplies, salaries, pension costs, health care, central services, purchased services, debt service, etc. The intent of the bill is not to require every local government to use the exact same chart of accounts, rather to summarize commonly understood expenditure types. So we changed the language from object code in the original bill to expenditure type to address that concern. The other main concern I've heard about the bill since it was introduced is related to the September 15th timing requirement for proposed budgets in Section 6, Subdivision 3. So we modified the language to require at least the total information on the budget if they do not yet have the detailed breakdowns. And once the city has adopted the budget, usually November, December, for sure by the 20th of December, those details then are posted within 14 calendar days. Again, to summarize before I turn it over to those who are here to provide testimony and additional background details on this, the intent is to provide a financial story which, in clear, easy-to-understand terms, lets our citizens know what services they are receiving in return for the payments they are making.
Mr. Chairman. Senator Daley, do you have one of these for state government?
We can work on that, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Discussion. Question. Senator Keeler.
Yeah, Senator Daley, I just talked to my city, Bloomington, and they do detailed analysis already. I'm kind of curious as to, you know, aren't these cities already doing this? And in some form or another, maybe not all exactly the same, but they already have all that info. That's all public information. So what I'm getting is this is an extra mandate, and also it's going to require more data gathering at a time when city budgets are already strained. And just can you give us a little bit of a background as to why this is needed when there's already a lot of reporting being done?
Senator Daley.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kielash, members, in the key phrase that you used, in some form or other, is directly related to why we need to do this. The information is there. Oftentimes it's buried, and it takes citizens hours and hours and hours, if they have the time, to dig that information out. This bill would require that cities present the information in a clear, easy-to-understand manner by expenditure type, not just by program area, not just by what was spent on police and fire and those programs, but by salaries, by pension, by health care, by supplies, how much are being spent in each expenditure category. And I think we can get into some more detail with some of the information that these testifiers are here to share with the committee.
So, Senator Daley, would this be used kind of to supplement their truth in taxation documents?
Mr. Chairman, supplement would be one way to look at it, certainly. It's to provide greater clarity and to make the information easier to understand. Thank you.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Daley. So where did this come from? Where did you get this idea to do this? I mean, is there an effort by people to get this to happen? I'm just curious.
Senator Daley.
Mr. Chairman, Senator McGuire, I will say that it is something that NIAP with Ms. Kay Rakow here, who's going to testify,
okay,
and several other groups did. It was kind of a simultaneous thing. I was reaching out, trying to figure out how to get greater clarity myself, and they had a bill that was heard in the House, but not in the Senate. So it was just felt kind of coincidental. I was looking for something like this at the same time they were looking for a Senate author, so it was almost simultaneous, really.
Thank you.
Further discussion? Okay. To the testifiers, Ms. Rakow, is it? Could you state your name for the tape?
Yes, I will. My name is Kay Rockle, and I am the Director of Public Policy for NIOP, the Commercial Real Estate Development Association, representing the interests of commercial real estate developers and owners and managers, along with the thousands of tenants that are in the buildings that we all own and manage. The issue that galvanized NIOP's public policy efforts was property taxes, because in the middle 80s, through actions of a number of different levels of government, deliberately more and more of the property tax burden was shifted to business properties. So since then, our primary focus remains business property taxpayers, but we've been focusing our efforts primarily on the state level because since 2001, there have been numerous attempts to increase the state general property tax. So we've been focusing our efforts on defending against those increases. But over the last couple of years, we started to hear some things from our members. First of all, our property managers started to say things like, I know we're doing a good job at the Capitol and we're working hard to defend the business property taxpayers against those proposed increases in the state general tax, but the taxes locally are going up. Isn't there anything we can do about that? The second thing we started to hear, and this came primarily from leadership on our board, our public policy committee, as well as just casual conversations. You know, we talk about property taxes, we talk about taxes in general, but we need to get at the spending side of things because that's what we need to understand. So ultimately, the board said, get a group of people together, get smart about what causes local property taxes to go up, what are the cost drivers, and report back. So we did. We got a group of around 15 NIOP members together, and we called ourselves the Nexus Task Force, the nexus between property taxes spending and between property taxes and spending. And we spent a huge amount of time, sometimes meeting every other week. We had city managers, we had city council members, we had mayors, we had county commissioners come in, we had labor negotiators, we met with House fiscal staff. We met with the League of Minnesota Cities. We met with tax assessors. We did everything we could to try to really completely understand Minnesota's complicated property tax system, plus the relationship between the financial relationship between state and local governments, which, as you know, there is a lot of finger pointing that goes on. One of the things we did learn, and we're all aware of the fact that multiple sources of non-property tax revenues, whether they're increasing or decreasing, has a big impact on local budgets. But we came down and said, but ultimately, spending is the most important piece of the property tax system and in many ways is the most challenging for taxpayers to understand. So this became especially clear to us when we started to look at local budgets. So we were surprised. We couldn't find quickly and easily what the cost drivers were. So as Senator Daley said, when you look at local budgets, the way they're presented by program area. So you see how much they spend on police, park and rec, economic development, general admin, et cetera. And in some cities and counties, you get incredible object code or expenditure detail in each one of those program areas. Others, they're lumped together in general categories. But the one thing that we can't find is where they aggregate those expenditure types across the budget and come up with one total. So that's what we're trying to do. So we're saying that in addition to the program area, we would like to see expenditure type as a complement to that, and then we also would like to see trend lines because trend lines are important, so we're asking for 4 years of information. So we know it's there. We're just asking that it be reported and presented along with the program information. A year ago last fall, I was at a conference over at the University of Minnesota. It's a policy conference that I'm sure a number of you have been at. And I went to one of the breakout sessions. And the breakout session was the Humphrey Institute describing a report that the League of Minnesota Cities asked them to do. I was struck by the key findings of that report. One is, cities will be broke by 2015. Another one was, by 2025, cities will face a 33% budget deficit. The next thing they said is, something needs to change. Lastly, in that report, it said that city expenditures are expected to increase by 5.5% through 2025, which is roughly a 49% over and above what the revenues are projected to be. So that gave us a greater urgency to say, if this is what's going on, as taxpayers, we need to have a better understanding of what the cost drivers are in our local budgets. I will say a couple of last things. This is not a replacement for program budgeting, because taxpayers clearly want to know what is being spent on program areas. This is just a complement to that, along with trend lines. The other thing is, this is not designed and it's not intended for jurisdictions to compare each other. This is meant for the taxpayers in a jurisdiction to have that information, to talk with their city council and their mayors, et cetera, about what's going on. And lastly, this is not a be-all, end-all to property tax understanding. This is just the beginning. And I appreciate your time and energy.
Thank you. Mr. Ranke?
Yes, sir.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the tape, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. It's Paul Ranke. I'm with two firms, or two entities. One is the Hogland Company, which is a commercial real estate development firm. Then also, I'm the a second-term council member in the city of Oakdale. It's a pleasure to be here tonight.
Continue.
Should I proceed?
Yes, sir.
The you know, it's interesting. My role on the NAOPS task force, which again is called the Nexus Group, is real unique. And I take some pot shots from my colleagues because of my role as a city council member. But I also am able to provide quite a bit of good information and dispel some misbeliefs about how at least city government works and city financing. In that Nexus task force, it's become acutely obvious that our member colleagues, people who own buildings, sometimes single-use buildings, many times multi-tenant buildings in all the communities within Minnesota, have an awful time understanding city and county budgets. As already been mentioned, the information is there, you know, in overwhelming detail, and more typically I found, at least in Oakdale, we've done it by program area, because at the end of the day, as a policymaker, I want to be sure that I'm meeting the needs stated or what we believe the needs are of the residents of Oakdale by the various programs that we offer. Now, as a property owner, again with Hogland Company, and we own and operate properties, we have a small company. It could be single user buildings like a bank. Could be a large multi-use building like 5000 France on the corner of 50th and France in Edina, my most recent project. If the sense is that property taxes flow through to my tenants, changes in those property taxes just get passed right on down. And the concern about this data being used to compare across communities and across cities and across counties is almost ineffective because it's not a very good tool. We're not requiring, we're not asking for standardized object codes because that's just not going to work. And each community, each city, each county is running their business, their shop differently, whether it's a municipal liquor store, a golf course, shared services with neighboring communities. So the intent here is that since a property owner has a building called $3 million in a community, I'll use Oakdale, I'm not going to move. But my tenants do. And so the ability to engage policymakers in a different way is just critical. And so the need for this type of legislation is high. As Ms. Rako suggested, back in 2010, the League of Minnesota Cities talked about the concern going forward with budgeting. And in their report, they talked about the need to think differently and to engage the citizenry in a different manner to figure out how we're going to spend our money and how we're going to raise money. What's the effect of services? So with that said, this is, in my mind, truly a nice way of giving people summary data across the way. And Senator, you had mentioned this data is here right now. It is. Absolutely it is. The need to aggregate it, so all the personnel services, you know, there might be 12, 15, 18 accounts, roll it up and shoot it across So it's another way of dealing with or thinking about where the costs are going. It's interesting that, you know, as for city council, I'm responsible, one of the people responsible, to figure out how to do the best we can. And if I shift people around within my departments or share services and eliminate positions or add positions to take care of a stated need, gosh, that's what I need to do. That makes it really difficult, kind of year in and year out, to explain to my citizens what happened to Parks and Recs. Well, in our case, we added a new community, or a Discovery Center, we call it, but it's a nature preserve, and we added people. What happened to fire and police? Well, I've got things going on, part-time people going back and forth, full-time people going back and forth, dedicating their careers to various departments. So, quite frankly, I'm not interested from a city council person or a property owner into the comparison thing across cities and counties, but I am interested in providing a tool for our citizens or with NAIOP, our member companies, member individuals, as a way to engage with the policymakers in a different manner, in a much more effective manner.
Two questions. Senator Kalish has a question.
Mr. Rinke, what I understand what you're trying to do with some of this, but I just can't help but wonder, with all this new information, how does that change the property owner's relationship with the city? How does this change anything about the current what you're currently doing? It just doesn't seem, you know, yeah, you got more information, but what do you do with it that actually is productive? Because it is kind of it's an unfunded mandate to the city to gather this extra information. What's going to change from the property owner's point of view in their relationship with the city or county or whatever?
Mr. Senator Chair and Senator, the 7 years I've been able to do the city council stuff, and sometimes I don't have enough patience to do it as well as I'd like. All that said, gosh, I bet you there's only been 3 property owners that have come to our truth and taxation or our budgeting workshops trying to understand what's going down, where we're placing our priorities, until they get their tax bill. Once they get the tax bill, you know, I get the phone call, or they come and complain about you know, the decisions we're making and the allocations we're making. I believe that a taxpayer, especially a commercial property owner, and in Oakdale we probably have some 4 million square feet of space in our little community, if they're concerned about it, and again, this is for the interested people, there's a whole body of people who are just not going to come, and they prefer to complain at the end of the day. But for the interested people, if property owner XYZ comes in and starts talking with me, engaging with me and my colleagues about the impact, what's going on with property tax increases to their tenants, you know what? I am going to listen to that, because they're one of the major funders, of course, for the property taxes. Whether we do anything different, I'm not sure. But I certainly am going to listen, and for more people to come in and be engaged at a little bit more substantial manner, that's important. And we have big problems to solve. So if we're going to increase taxes, you know, there's implications for it. I want to grow, you know, and I want to have more properties.
Sure. Senator Kalish.
Mr. Chair, one of the things that I don't quite get, though, is that you're a city council member. So this is an unfunded mandate to the city of Oakdale as well. So now that means you're going to have to make a choice whether or not you're going to who gets laid off, what other service gets cut in order to gather this information so that commercial property owners have more information to give you complain more intelligently about the budget. How's that sound? As diplomatic as
possible.
That's
what happens, yeah.
So, and that's why I'm not sure the value of that to either you as a city council member or even to them as property owners, if that we're really just talking about, you know, the information being a little better. The other thing is it's across the board, the whole state that's going to get hit with this, whether the city's affected by it or not. So could you just go on to that choices and And, you know, I'm still looking for the value in this information as far as a city council member goes.
Sure. Mr. Ranke, what value is there in giving taxpayers more information to argue with their city council about?
Mr. Chair and senators, you know, it's Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde, quite frankly, being very candid. On one hand, you bet. I, as a city council person, every single property owner should be in our council chambers asking us questions. The reality is, as you guys all know, that doesn't happen. I think it doesn't happen because it's a foregone, many times I think people think it's a foregone conclusion that we're going to decide what we want to decide, and off we go.
Mr. Ranke, couldn't taxpayers be looking for, you know, see their own property taxes for a variety of reasons go down, but to see their local unit of government spending actually increase very rapidly, and they wouldn't notice that unless they had, you know, detailed spending information? Mm-hmm.
Say that one more time, Mr. Chair.
It seems like your own personal property taxes could go down based on a truth in taxation, and there wouldn't be enough information there for you to see that the spending in the locality you're in is actually going up, even though your taxes, for a number of reasons, might be going down. And if you had the information you're talking about, you could see that the municipality or the local unit of government was actually dramatically increasing spending, but your value or something may have went down and you wouldn't notice it.
Mr. Chair, that's true. And again, this is, if it was just a standalone document that this is all people get, it's not very worthwhile. But between programmatic, over, you know, all the data that if people wanted, they can get it, and this aggregate summary across all the departments, I think it does become very valuable. You know, the thing, too, is that right now, let's see, back when, I'm going to say 4 years ago, we had the significant deficits being projected for the state, and some of us were concerned about it from a city council in Oakdale. And so our director, Susie Warren, I asked her for some summary stuff, and I couldn't even enumerate the terms. I just said, I need some summary stuff, and I'm concerned about these areas. Can you run it for me? She did. So it's only 3 years, if I recall, very simply. I asked her to do all the things that this bill is asking for and to keep track of her time and the level of difficulty, and she ran it, and I had it in a couple of days. When I asked about how much time, it was about, you know, 6 to 8 hours. And she said, no, wait a minute, though, because that's just this first time. I had to just ask for the codes to be done, the object codes to be aggregated. So if you do this next year and the year after, it shouldn't take that much time. So, yeah, there's going to be people coming probably after us expressing significant concern about the time it takes to do this. There's going to be time, but I think it's going to be very reasonable, and I still maintain it's beneficial.
Mr. Ranke, do you think that this bill would cause significant staff additions in your city if this were to pass?
Chair, no.
Yes. Senator Sieben, did you have a question?
Thank you. I did for Senator Daley. Senator Daley, it looks like on here that there's some on line 7.5 and 7.6, some real specific things that are required to be made available, including employee costs, wages and salaries, pension, Social Security, and so on. So would individual city staff's wages and benefits be listed under this, or is it an aggregate number?
Senator Daley.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sieben, it's my understanding it's an aggregated number, not individual.
Okay.
Certainly the intent is not to have it as individual salaries. It's to be aggregated.
Thank you. Are we going to hear from other testifiers, Mr.
Yes,
Chairman?
Yes, there's some people that not everyone's for this bill.
Okay.
Senator McGuire, did you have a...
I will save my questions. I'd like to hear from, you know, other people. I'd like to hear from the cities and from people about what this means to them.
Mr. Ranke, did you have a further comment?
Mr. Chair and senators, the other thing that I wanted to say is when I asked for the simplified information, you know, 4 years ago from our director of finance, it was given to me very easily. And if this is available on request, so if I as a city council member want to get it from my city, or a taxpayer wants to call or Susie Warren and get it, she's going to provide it. And I can see this happening, you know, 3-4 times, or depending on what's going on in the year, 8 times, 9 times. So the issue that is intriguing for me is that this is proactive. Do it once, do it complete, and it's done. And it changes the continual request of preparing this report. Thank you.
Okay, is there other testimony for or against Senate File 1741?
Mr. Chairman, as they approach the table, I would just like to share that I have discussed the timing with several different groups, and I'm certainly open to certain modification. I don't want this to be such an onerous mandate that is impossible to accomplish. And as we've just heard, it sounds like it should be reasonably achievable. The cost should be very low to these different entities. So I do want to achieve this, realizing it's a mandate, in a cost, not a cost prohibitive way, but in a cost achievable kind of way. So while there is an added requirement, and it's, if you look at page 6, lines 24 through 26, this is additional language since the bill was introduced, which I thought was going to be helpful, and I've recently heard that it may not be. So I'm certainly open to modifying this, and that is with respect to publishing the adopted final budget on the municipal website within 14 days of adoption of the final budget. We thought that was going to be more transparency and help achieve some of the goals of the intent here. I'm not certain that it will. Not certain that it won't, but I'm certainly open to that conversation here in this committee.
Thank you, Senator Daley. Is there a Ms. O'Rourke here? Welcome to the committee. Could you state your name for the tape, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jennifer O'Rourke. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. We're the statewide association representing all 853 cities here at the state capitol. We wanted to be on record with this bill today, and I have with me to the left Sue Iverson, who is a finance director in Arden Hills, who can much better hopefully answer some of your questions about the nuts and bolts of how city budgets work at the local level. But Senator Daley is absolutely right. We had a good conversation out in the hallway on this bill, as we did late last week, and seeing if there's a way to make this bill better. We do need to be on record opposing the bill today as it's introduced, and a lot of the pieces that you see in the delete all amendment before you. We do want to be on record letting you know cities do not have an issue with transparency and the transparency goals of this bill. We passed around a list, if you will, that's on League Letterhead outlining, I think, 14 or 17 reports that are already required for cities to submit to the State Auditor's Office and the Department of Revenue. It's everything from TIF reporting to budget summaries that end up on the State Auditor's website and such. And a lot of those are mandates, if you will, that we've had on our list over the years that folks on both sides of the aisle have been good about asking to carry bills on those topics. And as you all know, they're really complicated things to repeal or move back on. And I just ask you to consider that as you maybe move forward with this bill and discussions today and in the future on this bill. It's been very hard to get any mandate relief done in the last 10 years or whatever that we've been working on this topic. But I urge you to keep that in the forefront as you work on this issue. The second piece of paper that I had the committee hand out is something that I was glad the testifiers spoke to, and that's just a letter from the city of Crystal. When this issue first came forward, we had NIOP and the Minnesota taxpayers come into our legislative committee last summer to talk about the issue. We knew they were coming forward with a bill. I think we had a pretty good dialogue back and forth with a lot of elected officials from around the state as well as finance directors. And as this was introduced, the city of Crystal's finance director put together this bill, excuse me, this letter. And I thought he did an excellent job of outlining his concerns on a number of areas of the budget as it relates to a shared service that they have between, I believe, Crystal and New Hope, and that's a fire department. There's been a tremendous amount of pressure on local governments over the last couple of years to do more with less, but to do more with their neighbors and to provide services to their citizenry in the areas of public safety and whatnot that are shared with other departments. And sometimes those relationships work out for a few years, and then they end up dissolving those. But I just urge you to keep that in your mind as you move forward on this issue as well. I don't have anything else to state on this, but would be happy to turn it over to Sue Iverson if that is all right with you, Mr. Chair.
Certainly, Ms. Iverson. Could you state your name for the tape?
Yes. Good afternoon, Chair and committee members. My name is Susan Iverson, and I am the finance director for the City of Arden Hills. I am also active both at the National Government Finance Officers Association and at the state level. I also am a budget reviewer, and I teach and train in putting together budget documents, and I teach fund accounting to various people, both for the GFOA in Minnesota nationally and at the Clerks Institute. Some of the things that we noticed in here, again, we don't have a problem with transparency, but some of the things that they spoke to, most of us already provide our budget data to our city councils in that very format. But when we have to provide it to the state, we have to put it at a program level because it's not comparable if you take each of our object code or expenditure type data and compare it across the state. So we have to put it in a state auditor's format. But we do have that when we prepare it to our city councils and we put it into a packet and they get their council packets, which are public data, which are posted on our city websites. And then we do our truth and taxation hearings, which we also put all of that data into. So it's all broken down. And I actually have with me my summary where I do it across the entire city, all funds. Although in this bill it only talks about doing general fund, debt service funds, special revenue funds, and excludes enterprise funds, which I don't know why you'd want to exclude them, especially when you're talking about the categories of employee costs, because most employees are spread across the funds. My own salary is not, and my benefits is not just in general fund and special revenue funds. I would also be in the water, the sewer, the surface water, and so would most of my public works employees. So we have some concerns that they only want to pick certain ones to report. We already do report to the state auditor if you're looking for a format in our financial reports, which would probably be easy to just add to the budget summary reporting that the state auditor has because they had us break it down by governmental funds, special revenue funds, and they already have us break it down by number of employees and by salaries and benefits. So we already do that kind of reporting that's already in your state auditor's database. The second thing is that I have a concern when it asks for 4 years, they want two years of prior budget, the current year, and then your proposed. I don't know what those 2 years of current but or prior budget data is going to do because when we put our budgets together, we have 2 years of actual, the current year's budget, and then the proposed budget. I don't know what comparisons you're going to get from those 2 years of budgets when you have actual numbers to replace those. Again, my city council is pretty active. They get all of that data, and the public does, in all their city council packets. It's all put online. It's all made available to the public. And we do have citizens who come to our budget hearings and who ask questions, and they watch it very actively on TV. I many times will have emails at my desk before by the time I get done with my hearing. And when they call to ask me questions, I go through their particular property tax bill, but I also explain why property taxes have gone up or down. And a lot of times I explain to them the value component of it. I also explain to them the fiscal disparities component. And then we get into what all the factors are in the city, and we do it by expenditure type. We don't do it at program level. We summarize it at program level after we're done with expenditure type. So I guess one thing I would just say is it is an unfunded mandate to have to add some of this when we're already putting it on our website in council packets and things like that because storage costs on a website, at least for some. I've worked in a city of 350, of 3,100, you know, of 10,000, and I work at Arden Hills. And some of those cities, if they're using GovOffice because they don't know what else, they can't afford to do their own websites. It costs a lot to add extra pages and extra documentation, and some of those cities are going to have a hard time if they have to publish yet more information in greater detail on some of those websites.
Okay. Senator Kalish.
Yeah, I'm sorry I missed the name, but could you tell me what information they're asking, extra information besides what you're already reporting? And if it's not that much extra, is it that much different, the kind of reporting that we're looking, this bill's going to do?
I think most of our data is already in our council packet, and I, you know, we put it together in a book. And we detail it out, and then I have summary sheets that the council wants. What's happened in the past is I've had council members, and I had citizens who tell me, well, all that detail is great. We just want a summary. They said it's just too much for us to go through. And they understand what public works is. They understand what public safety is. But they don't really understand sometimes supplies and expense. Why is this supplies and expense? Why is that a contracted services? What, you know, if you go out and repair your truck, it's a contracted service. If you repair it inside and you buy parts for it, it's a material and supply. That has a big deal to do with liability insurance and where you classify it. And it gets too technical. And we were told a couple times that it's just too technical. Can you make it more in summary data for us? Which we do.
Just to follow up, one of my, I guess I'm not sure you got quite to the question, but you've already got the information. Is it going to, is what this bill does, what's this bill going to do as far as both gathering the information? It sounded like there's an expense for publishing it online and all the rest. So it seems to me the information is already there if somebody's willing to just do a little bit of digging or talk to them.
Yeah, it's there if you want to do a little bit of digging. I think the thing is like now, we do 2 years of actual and then we do our budget. We would have to change our programs to put in 2 years of budget. But if we then have to put in another whole separate report, that's where it's going to create the unfunded mandates of people putting them on their websites in yet another format. And then as far as reporting it, I don't know why we couldn't already just use what the state auditor's collecting for financial reporting and just add that same piece to the summary budget reporting that we have to do to the state auditor's office.
Thank you.
Additional questions, Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple questions, and I'm not sure who would be the best to answer those. But I thought I understood you to say, Ms. Iverson, that you're probably already doing all of the things that this is requiring, except they're being done on paper in a booklet that's handed out to council members rather than being put on the web. And my thought would be that certainly as budgets get more and more complex and larger cities, larger and larger budgets, that digital documents have a great advantage in that it's so much easier to search and to identify trends. And it's also easier for members of the communities to be able to look at these documents as well. And so I guess I have two questions. One, if you're already doing it, is it really that much more difficult to do it digitally, which, quite frankly, a lot of publishing today is going digital for many reasons that I already mentioned. And then the second one is, this might not be the best one for you to answer because I think you're already providing this information. My thought would be, if you don't have object-based recording, how do you identify cost drivers?
Iverson.
Okay. Mr. Chair, we do it all digital. What I'm saying is that we provide all of that detailed documentation that we give our city council. It's in our city packet, and it's published on the website before the meeting. It's also got public copies at the meeting for anybody who wants to come. We also participate in the GFOA's program where we have summary. We put our whole budget document on after we adopt our final budget. But these documents that are put on afterwards, while they may look really big, they have all that summary data in there. Plus, they have strategic plans, the objectives, the trends, what the city's facing, all those type of things by department. So those are in there. The other documentation I told you we were doing by hand, we do publish all that electronically, and it's out there. I just feel that the way they want us to put it is in another format is just reduplicating what we've already got out there for the public to see if the intent is to provide the documentation for the public by the truth and taxation hearing date.
Okay, Senator Nelson.
Mr. Chair, so if I understand you correctly, you support the bill except you're concerned about
the unfunded mandates.
Well, you're concerned about the format and you're concerned about the date, the timing. Is that correct?
Correct. Many times we don't get the information in order to complete our data, which I think he's addressed, from the county until the third week in August.
which leaves us the last week in August to meet with our city councils. We have to adopt that preliminary levy by the beginning of September, and so we're just, you kind of have to work backwards. You know, we have an idea of where our budget's at, but then we really don't know where our revenues are at until we get all our data from the county with the fiscal disparities, those type of things. And so then we have to look at that, we have to meet, and we have to make some preliminary decisions, and the council decides where to set the levy. But then we have to go back for another month or 6 weeks and really crunch out where those cuts are going to be if we have to, if there's levy limits, that type of thing, where we're going to have them. So we really don't have good data until probably mid-November.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Daley.
Just to clarify, I could save them a lot of work. We're not looking, the intent was not to go back and do the prior year's budget information. The intent is to use the actuals. So there's no intent to go back and look at what those budgeted numbers were. Just use the actual numbers. So if the language needs to be revised to accommodate that, to make that clear, we should do that.
Okay. Ms. Stengel, do you have a suggestion for us, or do you need a little time?
A little time, Mr. Chair.
Certainly. Ms. Stengel, do you have an idea of what you think this will cost your city in staff time? I'm sorry, Ms. Iverson?
To actually post another report other than what we put in our council packets, I could say that it probably would take about 8 to 16 hours of staff time every time we revise the budget.
Okay, thank you.
Mr.
Chair. Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Daley, remind me what the purpose of your bill is then, if they're already doing all these reports for truth and taxation. Remind me what part of this report that you think they're not already providing that you think citizens need to know about that they're not already getting.
Mr. Chairman, Senator McGuire, members, right now the reports that are available are by program area, so by police, by fire, by those different program areas. What we're looking for in this this bill is by expenditure type, so by salaries, by pensions, by health care, by supplies, those expenditure type categories.
So, Mr. Chair.
And the information is perhaps available, but it's you really have to dig, and you have to spend a lot of time trying to put that together. And the intent is to make it easily available, very clear and simple to understand for our non-CPA citizens.
Ms. Stengel thinks she has something to address this.
Mr. Chair, Senator Daley, perhaps you could let me know if I'm going in the right direction here. On line 6.15, after the word include, we could insert actual. So it would say the 4 years shall include actual data from the two most recent included budget years. Does that get at?
One more time, Council, please.
Sure.
The location, where?
Mr. Chair and Senator Daley, on line 6.15, about two-thirds of the way into the sentence, after the word include, inserting the word actual. So that sentence would then read, on 6.15, the 4 years shall include actual data from the two most recently concluded budget years.
Mr. Chairman, that sounds good to me.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to make that.
Senator Nelson, Ms. Iverson, do you have a comment on that? Does that address that problem?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Senator Nelson moves the oral amendment as read by Ms. Stengel. I'm going to go ahead.
To restate that, Mr. Chair, on line 6.15, after the word include, insert the word actual.
Okay. Discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? No. The amendment is adopted. Further discussion? Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I'll wait till I hear all the testimony, then I'll ask my question. So there's
Mr.
other people
Carlson, did you want to?
That want to testify?
Carson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Keith Carlson. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association, consisting of 13 of the larger counties in the state. I again want to reiterate the testimony of the cities that counties are not against providing additional transparency, additional information that will have assist with taxpayer understanding. But what we are against in this bill is providing misleading data due to timelines that simply can't be met, and incurring costs for new web or newspaper publication that I don't think really has been touched upon. But what this bill requires, if the community does not have its own website or is unable to publish it on its website because of lack of staff expertise to do that. What we do support is providing the information at a time and in a manner consistent with current law and reporting processes and schedules. As has already been identified, employee compensation and employee benefits information is provided to the state auditor when we submit our financial reports 180 days after the close of our fiscal years. The state auditor simply does not publish or report that information at this time. So a simple fix, frankly, is just requiring the state auditor to provide that information on his or her website. I do want to speak to some inferences not made by Senator Daley, but another discussion surrounding this bill that somehow local government spending is out of control. That's simply not the case. Right now, we are at a historic low in terms of the year-to-year increase that local governments have made in property taxes. Those property taxes increases have been way below trend line for the last 3 years now. And further, Minnesota, unlike perhaps in the state tax area, property taxes are below the national average, whether you look at it at either a per capita or a per $1,000 of income basis. If you flip over the one-page document that I presented that showed this information, the issue that really is affecting commercial and industrial properties, it's not local government spending, it's not local government taxes, it's the provisions of state law over which we have no control at the local government level. The average tax in Minnesota for 2012 expressed as a percentage of market value, or what's called effective tax rate, is 1.43%. Commercial industrial properties happen to be much higher than that at 3.7%, all because of the provisions of state law. If you simply would eliminate the state's property tax levy on commercial industrial properties, that would be cut by more than one quarter. So if, again, property taxes are the concern, much of it is being driven by, more than half of it is being driven by the state. To get to the issues of timing, I think it's already been explained to some extent. Basically, on September 15th, when cities and counties certify the preliminary levy, all they've done is establish their overall level of spending. They don't know, in many cases, the detail at that point. So the information is simply not available at that time to be reported. And the bill has amended, has made some exception to that. But, again, we would rather report the information when it's final, when it will not mislead the taxpayer and other interested citizens. To go on, then, it's also going to be very challenging for small cities and small counties to implement. Frankly, I don't represent the smaller counties. But I know in many instances you're talking about a one-person office that has multiple duties. In smaller counties, the budget person is the county auditor, who during the same period of time is responsible for administration of elections, is also responsible for the preparation of truth and taxation notices. The same would be true in cities, where the city clerk is really the person who's the staff person who's preparing the budget. They simply don't have the time to provide this information in a timely manner. Going on to the expense, which is our largest concern, if you do it outside the parameters of existing reporting requirements, we're already spending over $3 million annually to provide the truth in taxation statements and for the duties that go along with that. That's a substantial expense. Quite frankly, Minnesota property taxpayers are probably the best informed in the nation. They know the bottom line cost of local government spending, what it means to them, and frankly, given the turnout that we see at those hearings, most of them are satisfied that when there's a big bump, when there's a big change, they show up. But that's a relative rarity because that's not occurring. To go on, as mentioned by Ms. Iverson, we already report extensively. Besides the truth in taxation notices, we do two reportings of our budgets, one to the state auditor, one of which is a required publication in the newspaper. That, frankly, cost us money. In terms of our actual spending and our actual revenues, we also do two reportings of that. Again, one to the state auditor and one to is a required publication in this in the newspaper for counties. In fact, two newspapers in counties, and either in the newspaper or a city newsletter for the cities. We're already incurring substantial expense. I'll just kind of conclude at this point. You've heard testimony at this report of, well, doesn't seem like significant hours that are invested, but you've basically heard from relatively large cities. And they have the wherewithal to do it. Anoka County is the county that I'm most familiar with, who's probably closest to meeting this requirement. They don't at this time. They're missing one of the years of data. They are not currently providing the detail that's requested in terms of employee compensation, the breakdown that's requested in this bill. They've invested 100 hours in this, and they anticipate that they're going to invest another 100 to 200 hours. Now, they're going beyond what's required here, but it is substantial. And when you're a smaller county that's a one person or really a half or quarter time working on this, the wherewithal just isn't there. Again, you know, we can live with reporting that lines up with the current reporting requirements. What best would do that is at the time that we report our final budget data to the state auditor on January 31st, 1 month after we have adopted our budgets, to simply report the compensation data, which we already do as part of our financial reporting, basically 5 months later. With that, I'll conclude. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Mr. Carlson, do you mind if we forward your comments relating to the villainy of the statewide property tax to the governor?
Mr. Chairman, I have no reluctance over that. Again, it's a state decision. We don't dictate it.
Appreciate that. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I was going to comment on that, too. Many of us voted to get rid of that CNI property tax. I'm back on the timeline. And I think you said something there that I was looking for, which was you would hope that the state auditor would publish the data on her webpage, but it would be on January 31st. And my question is, how does that, if I understand that correctly, how does that timeline help citizens who are trying to understand the city budget, because it's already been adopted by that time? So I'm a little confused on that timeline piece and how January 31 would be of any value, really, to citizens who want that transparency that you've mentioned.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, we certainly wouldn't be adverse to, in the documents or the web publishing that occurs right now at the larger counties, larger cities, for providing it in the format, you know, specifically employee compensation and employee benefits consistent with the truth in taxation process, but basically when we are closer to finalizing our budgets. That would basically be in November, consistent with when the truth in taxation statements go out. Then we have a pretty good gauge of what the final numbers will be. I will mention that some cities, a municipal legislative caucus has identified a concern that letting out the budget for employee compensation at too early in the process will have potentially an adverse effect on negotiations. So I just want to make sure that you're familiar with that.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up.
Senator Nelson, to follow up.
Well, what would be adverse about data? I mean, what would be adverse about having that information available to the public?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Senator, you know, basically at the point that that information is published, what they're budgeting, the county, the employer, is showing all its cards, as I understand the concern that was identified by the cities that were represented by the Municipal Legislative Caucus. You know, they have concerns about doing that.
So who would be adversely affected? I guess I'm not clear on that yet.
The employer, again, I mean, I'm voicing this secondhand, has suggested a concern that will lessen their hand going into negotiations, that where they identify what they're budgeting before they really want to share it with the other side.
Senator Kalish.
Mr. Chair, one of my questions is I don't quite get this new information or this different stack of information or more detailed information, what that really gets anybody, and can't some of that, all that detailed information add to confusion as to what people are actually spending, especially if you don't know the details behind the numbers? And could you just comment on if there's really any, what's the benefit to the taxpayers with this extra information?
Mr. President, or Mr. Chairman, Senator Kalish, I would agree with Ms. Iverson that really the programmatic reporting of this information is probably the best basis. For example, if you wanted to look at snow plowing, one city that does it in-house with its own employees, one that contracts out. What's important to the taxpayer is what's the bottom line? How much is it costing me? It shouldn't make any difference whether it's contracted out or whether it's done in-house. What's the bottom line? By separating out employee compensation, basically the community that does it in-house, even though they're doing it cheaper than the community that contracts it out, will look potentially bad for somebody who doesn't dig down into the details. So we do have that concern. But again, the information is available. It is public data. If the will of the committee, the legislature is, they want to do it, fine. Just do it at a time that fits our current reporting cycle. Don't ask us to incur additional costs for either putting it on our websites when we may not have the in-house talent, or incurring additional publication costs for those who have to publish to meet the current requirements of this bill.
Okay. Further questions? Mr. Berenson? Did I pronounce your name right? Bo Berenson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Bo Bernstein. I work for the Association of Minnesota Counties. You've already heard a lot of the concerns from city and county folks. I certainly don't want to belabor the points that were made. Our organization does see this bill in its current form as an unfunded mandate. We appreciate the chair's, the author's willingness to talk to us about this, work through some of the issues we have, and we will continue to have those conversations with them.
Thank you. Any further questions? Anyone else care to testify for or against Senate File 1741?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir. State your name for the time.
Sure. My name is John Thorson with the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, Council 5, AFSCME Council 5. I wish, too, to go on the record expressing concerns about some of the content of this bill, echoing concerns raised by the employers we work with in terms of the timing, the ability to throw this information together, and raising two additional. It appears that even though this information is currently available as reported to the State Auditor's Office. The expansive breakdown of employee costs asked for in this bill, subdivided into wages and salaries, pensions, Social Security, health care, and other benefits, highlights a cost that doesn't necessarily weigh factors that end up being cost drivers. At no point is the additional information being asked to look at the other inputs or the drive service need, caseload, for instance, property values, for instance, and such. And again, we have concern about creating sort of a one-to-one comparison with just the costs as described in this bill with property tax increases. And then a final concern, subdivision 5 on page 7, the penalties for not complying with this. It's a pretty severe stick. It says failure to provide results withholding and state aid road funding, local police, firefighter relief association, amortization aid, local government aid, and county program aid. And again, that's a fairly heavy stick in terms of not complying with information as requested.
Further discussion? Seeing none. Senator. Senator Chamberlain moves that Senate File 1741 be recommended to pass and be referred to Judiciary. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? No.
No.
Motion prevails. The bill is passed and we refer to the Judiciary Committee. There'll be no further business before the committee. This meeting is adjourned.
7-6.
Stuff, yeah. About the time, but maybe, so maybe no, maybe we can't. Maybe we can't get the taxpayers.